Hello again and welcome back, everybody. This is Julie Knutson with episode 42 of Training the Pointing Labrador. And today's episode isn't going to necessarily have anything to do with the upland part of things. And I've talked quite a bit about that. And what I want to do today is cover two topics that are heavily related to some questions and emails that I've gotten. And things that I think are very, very important, particularly at this time of season right now. I'm going to talk about the first thing I want to talk about is how to prepare for the test that everybody is, you know, finishing off this September and October, and we're going into the national events at the end. So I want to talk about those things and some ideas about preparing for those that you may or may not have thought about before. Some stuff I think people are missing a few times when they're banking a lot, driving a long ways, paying hefty entry fees, and then going, I don't understand why my dog did that. He never did it, you know, this week or whatever. So I want to talk about an approach toward that particular problem. And the other thing I'm going to talk about is dog fitness. And usually when I start in on that with people, their eyes kind of glaze over and they go, oh, here she's going to do that again. It's a life-saving kind of a thing, and I'm going to talk fairly briefly but about the importance of dog fitness and things that we all can do on a daily basis to make sure that we keep our dogs that way. What is dog fitness? You know, a lot of people don't really exactly know what that is, and I want to talk about dog fitness because I, you know, again, it's the well-being and longevity of your dog, so that's a real important deal. But let's get to the test part first. So I have had a number of people that have said, you know, that are getting ready to go run their dogs and things. And, you know, they've done everything they know how to do. They've done all the prep work, and they've set up the marks and the blinds, and they've done all the work, and they go to a test, and then their dog does something which they think is very uncharacteristic. And I've had, I think, four people, when they tell me what's going on with their dog, it's, oh, he's great. He did the marks really well. And then he did this blind well, but boy, in the water, he just blew me off. And I've heard that four different people in the last, I'd say 4 days, I have heard people say that. And that, you know, they don't understand because the dog had done so well in training. And, you know, they had been cooperative and agreeable, and they just thought, I have this dog very, very ready. And then they do, interestingly, the same kind of thing. And usually if dogs are going to kind of blow you off, it tends to be on a blind, right? Because that's where they're doing, they're not working independently. They are working completely dependently with you. And so that's the place, obviously, that sometimes they can just kind of go rogue on you and do their own thing. So that little piece of information that I just gave you right there is kind of important to understanding the beginning of your problems on this. So they did great on the marks. Again, independent work for the most part. And not so much on the blinds. So I don't understand because they've been real good. Well, in training, of course, you know, you have electric collar on, I hope, in training, and you can enforce your standards and make sure they do stuff. Now, they know this, right? These dogs that are at the upper level things, they know. I'm in training. This person can enforce everything I have to do, so I just need to comply as much as possible. So when you do that all week or weeks or months getting ready, and the dogs always comply in training, right, when you can make them, don't misread that. As therefore, when I go to a test, they will exhibit the same behavior. Obviously, they aren't. So, you know, I know what the question is there. Well, what am I supposed to do? Train without a collar? No, it never do that. But when your dog does whatever they do, whether it's on the marks, all of a sudden they just blow through the mark and run past it and make very little effort, right? That tells you something. Here they are working on their own, and they're basically just going, I'm going to just go do what I feel like and not what you want, right? In the independent work, That tells you something either about that dog or what you've been doing in training. When they kind of do their own thing on a blind retrieve, which is very dependent work, well, then they also, that's kind of telling you something too. And it can be, dependent on the dog. There's not some thing I can say. Whenever they do it on a mark, that means this and this and this, because it doesn't, they're all real different. But you have to believe what you see. So when you're going somewhere, and usually a test, a trial or something, and the dogs do something that they normally don't do in training, one, I understand the complete and total mystification when you're fairly new to this, but what you need to do instead of being shocked and surprised, go ahead and start out that way, but then step back, remove yourself from the emotional aspects of this situation if you can. Because if you're all involved, how could you do that to me? We've been such a good team, and how did you do this to me? And when you get the emotion in it, you're not going to be thinking very well. So when you want to evaluate something like this, kind of pretend it's your training buddy or your, brother-in-law or somebody else. And if their dog did this, how would you evaluate that? If they said, what do you think's happening? You've got to take your own emotion out of it, the disappointment, the frustration, the betrayal, because it feels a little bit like that. It's like, oh, I thought we were so good. So if you look at when your dog does uncharacteristic, I call it kind of going rogue things, operating on their own, not listening to the whistle, not going where you send them, things like that. Right? This dog is telling you something. And different dogs have different natures of their message. But what the dog is telling you is, I'm just going to do this myself, thank you. I don't want to listen to you anymore. Now, that could be a number of reasons. That could be because you've been nagging the heck out of them in training, just insisting on teeny tiny imperfection and just nagging. And a lot of times people don't evaluate their own actions towards their dogs. But if you're nagging the dog and just getting on them and pushing the button a lot, or giving, 12 commands while you're standing on the line, when you lose that simplicity that I always tell people, if you're working with a dog, I think is so important. When you're just on them and shifting and moving and doing all this kind of stuff and then getting them for every little thing wrong, they kind of, just like you would in that situation, you build up a little bit of resentment. Now, dogs, I don't believe, intellectualize resentment. They don't go, boy, you're nagging the heck out of me, so I'm going to wait till Saturday and during test day, and then I'm going to not listen to you because I don't have to. They don't intellectualize that, believe it or not, even though everyone accuses dogs of doing that. But what they do is they're just getting poked and poked and poked and poked and poked. And so when they go to an event, suddenly their wings are free, all right? And they just kind of ignore the source of the poking and go run and do their own thing. Sometimes that's why dogs do uncharacteristic things. Another, and that's not all of them. That's not what, when you have it, that's not always what it is. With some dogs, if you're just poke, poke, nag, nag on them, sometimes that's what it is. Now, on the opposite side of that, and a lot of people I know, I think this is more what we're talking about. When, you just love your dog, right? And you go out and you train them and you try to set up the right kind of stuff. And you kind of try to do the right kind of marks and blinds and this and that. And you do it and the dog's cooperating and the dog does what you ask. And you're going, I don't know how I could be any more ready. They're running the blinds, they're taking the cast, they're getting in the water. They're diligently hunting the area of the fall. They're not getting wild and crazy on me. This is awesome. Now, believe it or not, for some dogs, that's perfect. When they're like that, they're going to go in on Saturday and they're going to do the same thing for you. Other dogs, and I can't tell you exactly why, but some other dogs, when everything has gone really well and they haven't had to mentally or emotionally kind of bear down a little bit and kind of hump up a little bit, when they haven't had to do that because things are going so well, then when they go to a test, which is more relaxed, more open, there's a greater sense of freedom. When they go to a test, then this, you know, gosh, this has been such a great week and I am out here, and they began to engage with their own feelings and their own thoughts and their own stuff. And in doing so, in their, you know, glee for being out there, or enjoyment or conviction or confidence in what they're doing, then they kind of ignore you and figure that they kind of know better or choose to do something differently than you ask. So it's not because you nag the heck out of them that they're doing it. There's no resentment whatsoever. Matter of fact, there's a little bit of the opposite of resentment, and that would be a little sense of entitlement because everything's been so smooth and so nice. So I don't want people to misread that, because there are some dogs who, when everything is going really well in training, that is means everything is going to go really well this weekend. When you haven't had to get after them a little bit, when you haven't had to enforce some things a little more strongly than normal, when you haven't had to kind of reset your balance of power, when you haven't had to do that, the dog is just optimal in that condition. Now, there's not a lot of dogs like that, I'll tell you that, but there are some. Then there are those dogs, just like people, when everything is going really well, they relax. They relax mentally. They relax emotionally. And then when they go to the test, golly, they're just feeling it and they're just feeling really good. And the balance of power has shifted way over to them because you haven't done anything to remind them that the balance of power is on your side, not theirs, and that they always need to be aware of that. So I don't know if that, I hope that makes sense to people, but most of the time when dogs do some unexpected freewheeling thing, generally if I talk to people, they'll find out that the week was great. Gosh, the week was great. He did everything I wanted to do. They were awesome. So that little balance of power thing, which is not a steady rock solid deal, it's sort of like a unicycle. It's going to roll one way or it's going to roll the other way. And so when you haven't had to do whatever it is that you do, that makes that dog, as I have said to a few of you, get into yes sir or yes ma'am mode. When you haven't had that, and so then when you go to the test is when they just really exert the freedom that they've had, and because there's been nothing to remind them, you need to be aware, you need to think about me. I am very significant. Part of dog training, period, and certainly part of dog training in preparing for tests and events is to make sure you know where that balance of power is. It is not defined by how well they're doing. How well they're doing is a reflection of the dog's ability, your good training, the setups that you're doing. That's what that's a reflection of. You need a dog, so yay for that, but that does not tell you what the balance of power is. You want to go into expensive, significant events that you need to do something with, depending on your individual dog, with them being, reminding them, letting them know that you are still tremendously significant. Even test day, even today, even when, you know, there's been relative success, they have to have some things in there where they're going, golly, I gotta keep my mind on what they're doing. Oh, I gotta remember that whistle's really important. You know, if they give me a left cast, I need to make my best effort to take a left cast. So in training, folks, for people with those dogs, when everything's going really well, depending on the kind of dog you have, if it's one of these ones that the yes sir, yes ma'am thing must be present most of the time, and frankly, with every dog I train, that's always a factor in my mind, is I need to make sure that this dog, doesn't mean I'm always successful at it, this dog needs to always be concerned with, you know, my take on things and what it is I'm asking. So how you do that, you know, it just depends on your train. You can use some indirect obedience pressure. You can set up some things or just require a little bit more crisp responses. If the responses are pretty good, that make sure that's not good enough. Pretty good's not good enough. Let's have it just as crisp as possible. There's a lot of places you can get into this dog's head so that in addition to carrying out the things that they love and the things they've been trained to do, they maintain riding along on their shoulder this concern for you and what you think and what you're asking. And that all occurs in the weeks and days ahead. So like I said, depending on the dog you have, if everything is just going super, super well, that always just worries me to death. Because I know that they're starting to feel it. They're, that balance of power is moving away from me and over to them. Because, shoot, they're just running and doing things well. And life is awesome. And that's good to a point. But not where they're going to go out and freewheel sometime in the middle of a test. And not listen to me, not take a cast, not make a good, diligent effort. So for people whose dogs do, you know, kind of unexpected things, it could be a number of things, and it could be something that I haven't described here, but generally they fall into these categories. Assuming that you have prepared the dog for what's out there, assuming that, you know, have done the kind of upfront preparation work so the dog can handle what's ever coming up, then it's something that you have allowed that dog to think. Or in the case of nagging the heck out of them, it's a resentment that you have created by overdriving, by just being too much in their face. So it's not just a trivial, easy thing, even when you have a really good dog, to go and do really well, because you've got this dog state of mind which is governing all of your success. And so the more you can get into the dog state of mind and understand how that balance of power works with their state of mind, that's what's going to help you be as successful as, you know, possible on these tests. So something to think about. If you guys have questions or comments on that, let me know. But it's easy to talk about that stuff after you've done it a zillion times. But I wish somebody had told me this right off when I first started, you know, and I would do all the right things and go through all the right motions, and I wouldn't always understand why my dog did something counter to that in an event. But now that I've learned about this, you know, their state of mind and this balance of power thing, and it's not the same for all dogs. There's some dogs that I just cookie treat all the way up there. You know, I just want to, everything's got to be rosy and rainbows. And there's other dogs, if I did that, we'd be out before the second bird hit the ground. So you got to understand your dog, and you've got to understand the balance of power and where that needs to be going into events. And how do you establish that with your dog without nagging the heck out of them, without, you know, just crushing them, or, you know, without just annoying them to death. So from between now and next year, that would be a good thing to work on with your dogs and really get where you could understand. And whatever works for you and your dog may not work for the guy right next to you. So don't, you know, then tell everyone this is what you need to do, because it really does vary with the dogs. So food for thought on how to get dogs to the best of your ability, not to do screwball things after you've paid an entry fee, because it is. It's frustrating and it's defeating. And again, you feel a little bit betrayed, but they don't betray you. They're just reflecting, you know, how things were going between you going on into this. So that's a little bit on test failure. And there's a whole lot more on those things, but something to think about for you serious test guys. Now I want to talk about dog fitness. Now this is incredibly important. And when I use the word incredible, I'm not using it like superlatives, like you just throw out, oh, amazing. This is so, so, so significant. I mean, it is for us, for human beings. But we have all kinds of emotional things and you know, stuff in our lives that, and psychological stuff that affects our relationships with food and with fitness. So I'm not going to make direct comparisons between people and dogs, but it's also very critical for us. So fitness, when we're talking about dogs, is, and for me, I think this goes for the lap-sitting Lhasa Apso, and for the high-performance upland dogs that hunt for hours and you know, at kind of an extended run. This goes for all of them. But I'm going to talk about specifically performance dogs. And you guys with hunting dogs that are getting ready to head out to South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, Texas, you know, down south, Arizona, California, wherever it is you're going to do this, you need to have the dog actually ready for this. Because when a dog is particularly upland hunting, now when you're sitting in a duck blind and they swim out, you know, 25 yards and pick up a duck or two and come back, now there is fitness associated with that. But that's a little bit different. When you have a dog that you're going to head out and you've got, you know, a section that you're going to hunt or a portion of a section or, you know, whatever it is you do, cactus and stickers and nasty things down in Arizona and wily coveys of quail. There's a lot that goes into this. So first and foremost, you know, the dog has to mentally understand their game. That's not what we're here to talk about today. But if you're taking a dog that's never hunted out to upland hunt, you know, good Lord, who knows what's going to happen? Maybe they'll figure it out. Maybe you'll just have them run with other dogs and learn by osmosis. You know, it'd be really nice to have the dog just prepared and understanding about using the terrain and the wind and their nose and their brain and their eyes to find these things. But when they do this, most of these dogs are moving fairly quickly. Some of them are at a pretty extended trot, you know, the more methodical guys, depending on where they are. And some of them are at a lope, you know, they're at a gallop. They're running and running through stuff and over stuff and under stuff and around stuff. And it is very, very vigorous. It is very much like running a 10K, which is 6-point-something miles. It's like running a half marathon. It's like running a marathon. Because when you walk half a mile through a field, as you know, your dog has probably gone, I don't know, 5 miles, 4 miles, depending on how they move. So extended running is a part of what they're doing. Now, when you hunt ducks, you know, in cold, icy water, I tell you, I don't know if you've ever swum in cold, icy water, but that's physically very demanding, even if you have their little fancy neoprene vest on. So even when you're just a waterfowl hunter or just a goose hunter or you hunt cranes and you might have a 50-yard sprint or a 100-yard sprint, you've got water land sprints. All sprinters in the human world train a lot. They have extremely good cardiovascular fitness. And all they do is run 50 yards or 100 yards. And they work very hard to do that. One, so they can go rapidly. Two, so that they don't get injured when they do it. That's one of the main reasons that track people train a lot. So when they do their thing, they aren't going to sprain things, tear things, rip things, damage things, and they can continue to compete and do their thing. And it is so true with our dogs. So all of you guys that hunt or compete, you know what's involved in there. It's wind sprints or it's you know, cross-country running. All of those things require a fully developed, that their heart is strong, accustomed to the demand, efficient in dealing with the demand, and the same thing with the lung system, which is tied, of course, directly into the heart. That's where the oxygenation occurs. To go do this without being injured, without using twice the energy that they would normally have. A very fit dog moving through the field may use half or less of the energy than an unfit, overweight, big dog that's not conditioned, not efficient at just the movement through difficult places. So they burn more calories. The big, fat, out-of-shape guy burns way more calories than the one that's fit and moves through there with us, wasting the least amount of energy as possible. This is so important. So that requires that these dogs who are doing this have a cardiovascular system that has been trained to a level that it can go out there and do this without being compromised, without getting out of breath, without being terribly stressed, without overheating. Now, you know, if it's hot enough, a fit dog will overheat. But an unfit dog can overheat in conditions that wouldn't touch a dog that had a lot of fitness. So there's so many bad things that can happen to a dog that is not physically prepared to go do something very demanding. Just like with you. I don't know what you are. But if you're not, you know, training all the time, and I dragged you out and said, all right, we're going to run from here to Fort Morgan, 25 miles. Well, you're probably going to say no, unless that's what you do. And I would drag you out, and probably within a short period of time, half a mile, 2 miles, I don't know, 4 miles, you know, you're going, I can't go any farther. I feel I'm about to throw up, or I can't breathe, or my heart's palpitating, or whatever. Okay, that's unthinkable. You, of course, you would not allow that. But people do that with their dogs every single season. You know, they put him out in the backyard. He's running around chasing squirrels or chasing the other dog. Yeah, that's good. And then you go out and you hunt, and you get upset sometimes. They start following other dogs. They come back and walk with you. Because when they're very fatigued, for you upland hunters, when they're fatigued, their mouth's hanging open, trying to get as much oxygen in as they can't smell stuff. They'll go right past birds, right over a bird, just because they can't smell, because they're just trying to be okay. So it's important that these guys have this level of fitness. So how do you get this fitness? Now, I know a lot of people are going, I'm not running. Don't even tell me to run. I'm not going to get out there and do that. But most people can ride a bicycle. And so if you, and I've told this to so many people, and I love their face. They just look at me like, oh man, you're crazy. But if you, I don't care, get an old bicycle. Buy, you know, get one from the Goodwill that somebody, give one that's just doesn't even shift gears or whatever. And go to your local, you know, bike path, your local open space, your dirt road. If you got to drive 40 minutes out of town to get on a dirt road, attach the dog to you with a leash if you can't trust what they're going to do. And teach that dog, start slowly. You know, if you're not in shape, then you have to start slowly too. You know, go ride a half a mile down on, come back half a mile on your bike. Going at a pace where the dog is in an extended trot. You know, and at first, it's funny when you first start this with dogs. They're in front of you. They don't know what's happening. They put their foot under the tire. I mean, it can be very difficult in the beginning. But they come to love this. And after a while, they learn to stay over on your side and go with you. And pretty soon, you don't even need a leash. So there are, you know, you can run. Running, you can. Walking is good. But you're going to have to walk quite a ways, because that means the dog's going to have to either be walking with you or running around, you know, around you. And it's going to take a half hour at least, you know, and you need to extend that more. If you're going to go hunt for 2 hours, you know, it'd be nice if your dog knew how to go out there and move efficiently for an hour or two. It would be good if they learned how to take water in the middle of that. Just like if you were going to go bike riding or running or cross-country skiing or whatever it is you do, okay, you can't, after about a half hour, you're going to need water. If you're, I don't care, moving slowly or moving fast, you're going to need water. It's important. So whether your dog likes to drink water or not, they need to learn to take water. So you can use like a squirt bottle, a bike water bottle, and just squirt it down their throat. And pretty soon they learn to accept that. But you're going to have to water them. But if you can get out, running would be great for you. Bicycling would also be great. Take the time. You know, do it. You know, I know life is busy. I understand that. But if you have time to go hunting, you do need to get your dog in shape. So go 2 or 3 times a week. And start with something that's doable for you and your dog without hurting them. And then slowly build up. You know, ideally, they tell people 10%, increase your distance 10% a week. Don't just do, you know, 1 mile today and 5 miles next week. That's obviously too much. But you need to build up the dog's cardiovascular system. You need to build up the tendons and the muscles that might just be kind of weak and soft from lack of demand. So, you know, many dogs go out and they get soft tissue damage. They get it in an elbow or a shoulder or in a ankle or knee or something, and those things can become very serious. You stress a tissue, you know, some ligaments out a little bit, and then you take them hunting and you do it again and again. Things can tear, things can swell up, things can be very painful. So ideally what you want to do, preferably, it's already best about hunting season right now, is to go out and start building up your dog's cardiovascular system, the muscles, the tendons, the shoulders, the hips. The shoulders, This is real important. The shoulders and front end of a dog is its support system, right? The rear section is the drive system. That's the engine. So it's the drive that the rear section gives it the big push, and then they land on their shoulders. So when a dog is not have the strength built up, lots of things happen. In the back legs, the knees get very stressed, and you can get the cruciate tears, and man, that's expensive, and it when one goes out, the other one goes out because of an imbalance. So on the drive section, you want to build up strength slowly without stressing the design criteria for all the tendons and ligaments that the dog has. You want to build that up. On the front, on the support system, the part that hits the ground, you want to build that up slowly too, because it's going to be subject to a lot of compressive stress. And then, you know, they get a little thing in the shoulder, and you can't quite tell, is it the elbow, is it the shoulder, no, is it the foot? So you slowly build up so that those things, those support system up there, strengthen and can take compressive stress. Now, for those people who like to throw balls and say, I just throw, you know, whatever, I throw frisbees, I throw balls, I do retrieves for my dog. That's how I get them fit. I would tell you, I will never do that ever, 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 ever. And here's the reason. If you look at the structure of a four-legged animal, like I just said, the back end is the engine. That does all the push and the drive. The front end is the support system. So that's what lands. So they are designed, if you look at their legs, their knees, their front leg, their shoulders, if you look at that, it's all straight. It is meant to take stresses and forces in one direction, forward and a little bit up and down on that front end, a little bit up and down, because it lands on the ground and moves forward. When you introduce the crazy throwing things where they run out there and they grab the ball or whatever you're throwing, and they dig in sideways with their front end, sideways, so you got more stress on one side than the other, and they grab that thing and come running back to you, and the back knees hit at different stresses to both of them, and when they always turn to the left to pick up whatever you got, then the forces on the left side, that tends to get more stress than the outside forces, and you get this imbalanced stress on the various joints and things not the way they were designed. You begin to break them down, preferentially one side more than the other. And so many injuries occur from dogs who are exercise retrievers by throwing stuff. And, you know, you can throw, I throw it for half an hour. And if you could look at a design breakdown of the stresses on the right side versus the left side, and the sideways forces on the elbows and the shoulders and all that, and the hips too, and the knees, the sideways forces that these dogs were not designed to have a lot of, you are destroying a dog body. And maybe they're, you know, some of them are lucky and they go their whole lives doing that and nothing happens. But for every one of them, there's a whole bunch of them that's like, I don't know what happened. Man, his shoulder's real tender. I didn't, you know, we took him hunting, maybe. But it's because of all this sideways stress and stuff that they put on dogs. So the things that you do with your dog to spend their energy and to get them exercise, you should think about a little bit. And again, I don't ever do that wild, crazy throwing. I don't do it at all. I mean, I just don't do it. Maybe on some little puppies, some happy bumpers, that's the most I'll ever do. Because if you could look at that sideways, just freeze. Take a pictures of a dog and freeze while it's turning in the air sideways. And if you could get a mechanical engineer to break down the forces on that left elbow and that left shoulder and that left ankle and those knees and see how it's 100 times more on this side than that side, and you do that with some repetition, wow, you have exceeded design criteria and bad things can happen. That's why when you're developing the cardiovascular system and the muscles and the strength, it's best done in the way they're meant to move, in a forward motion, not violent, not sideways. So a run or a ride on the bike for starting out with 10 minutes, start out with 15, build it up where they can go out there an hour and come back in like, hey, that's it. That's all we're going to do. Now you're getting somewhere and you're not causing damage to things completely unknowingly and unwittingly. So be real careful of violent action and sideways angular motion. And if you just turn your dog out to play with another dog and call that exercise, again, you're not developing consistent cardiovascular. What you would like to do, just like I would say, it's like a cross-country runner. That's what you need. A dog that can go out and hunt in the field, move efficiently, not have acquired the violent, crazy action, have strength when they do change directions and they do put, sideways stresses on their structure, and that their heart and lungs are really efficient and they use the least amount of energy as possible and so can hunt as long as you need them to and not get damaged or hurt or give up or get sick or get overheated. So that's real, real important. Also, if you're going to hunt for 2 hours, just like you, if you went on that run with me from my house to Fort Morgan, we'd have to take some snacks with us because generally people need some nutrition and so do dogs. So you can take, and not your cookies and not a jelly donut, but some healthy kind of, they use Purina used to make power bars. They don't anymore, but something like that so that your dog has the nutritional energy that it needs while it's doing this. Most importantly, whether you got a sprinter, a waterfowl guy, they still need the cardiovascular development. They need the strength. They need to be able to sprint, come back, and not be damaged by any of the things that they've done. So have your dog fit because it's very expensive if you don't. And those of you that have had to pay vet bills because of a cruciate or a elbow or something or an unknown soft tissue damage, like, I don't know how that happened. It's much easier and less expensive to go out, get on your bicycle, drive out to the country road, ride out there for a half hour, begin to get this dog in shape, and teach them that when they do stuff with you, it's with you. There's a heavy training aspect to this as well. You're a team, and you're still the one that they pay attention to. You define the speed, the direction, all of that. So that's my soapbox on fitness, but I don't know how many times I've seen dogs suffer a lot and be damaged just because somebody decided not to get them ready or thought that throwing a zillion happy bumpers or balls was the key to it, because that does more damage than it does good, actually. So I wish everybody has a successful rest of the test season, thinks a lot about what they're doing with their dogs. And the fitness thing, you guys, please think about your dog and that body and what you want them to do, and do everything you can to get them prepared. And in doing so, if it helps you get a little more fit, all the better. So I'll be back soon.